Well, it's that time of the month again. It's time for our April superdelegate Q&A. I don't know. We let this one slip out of our fingers, folks. Apologies. The next month will not be so late. But by way of penance, we're going to make this one really, really good. So you've got questions. We've got answers. I believe these were submitted by May the 5th. So we are very late on this one, Will. But we got an interesting assembly of questions here. Perhaps you can start us off.
Liam asks to both, if you could rule any country besides the US or Canada with a brutal vanguardist fist, which one would it be and why? Well, yes, there is a country.
This is so easy.
There's a country in the news right now I would love to rule with a brutal and vanguardist fist.
No. This is the wrong. There's a right answer to this question. There's only one answer. The answer is China. Obviously, it's obviously China. You know, if you want to make changes of world historic importance just by virtue of scale, it's got to be China. And I don't know, you could institute reforms or something. This reminds me of something Justin Trudeau was once asked. This is like a minor, like early Justin Trudeau controversy. You don't really hear about it much anymore, I think, because liberals dismissed it. And also because like it comes up in, I don't know, like the conservative media sphere, because people took it literally rather than seriously. I think they should have taken it seriously, not literally. But back in, I guess it was 2014 or 2015, there was this absurdly branded Justin Trudeau event. It was like Justin Trudeau in Ladies Night or something. If you search Justin Trudeau Ladies Night, you can see the poster, and I'd encourage you to do so. It's a fun reminder of how Trudeau was being packaged in those days. And he got asked, like, you know, it's like softball questions and stuff. And then he got asked, like, you know, what foreign regime or, you know, government or, do you most admire? And, you know, could have said Sweden, could have said anything. And he said, oh, I admire China because, you know, it's a basic dictatorship.
So he liked it. Not only did he pick China, but he picked it for the right reasons, too.
Right.
Not the alleviation of poverty, not for, you know, all those $9,000 electric vehicles, specifically for no free speech.
Yeah, that's right. I do think there's a way you could interpret this. Like, so obviously, right, the right, in what it often does with liberals, it's sort of seized upon this, and like during the convoy protests in 2023, like, or was that 2022? I've already forgotten.
Fuck, man. I can't even remember. It could have been any time.
So during the convoy protests, you know, you'd see this quote like bandied about as if like, well, this is like, he told us he had a secret plan to like instantiate a dictatorship or something. It's like, I don't think that's at all what Trudeau was saying, but I do think it's possible. One could interpret it as like, it was a little bit of his like bread to be part of the ruling class ideology coming out, where he was really saying like, oh, well, it'd be nice to be able to just like operate, you know, sensibly according to, you know, neoliberal third way principles without democratic impediments, like, you know, having to compete in elections and stuff. Like, can't I just be the person I've been bred to be, which is like the guy who has Ladies Night and is a sort of national mascot who has the right last name? Anyway, we're getting a little far afield from Liam's question, but I wanted to give him something a little more because there's only one answer to the question. It's China. Jerry says, when Luke Savage referred to commodity fetishization as you were discussing minimalist art, I couldn't help but think of NFTs. What are the key differences between the fine arts world and the NFT market? It seems to me the main difference is that in the latter, the supposed value comes from a speculative asset market without even the veneer of any aesthetic consideration behind it, whereas in the former, it comes from a managed market curated by various types of people who give legitimacy to the valuations with their supposed fine taste. Of course, this will differ depending on the critic, gallery owner, curator, etc. in question, but to what degree is the reputation warranted, and to what degree is it an emperor's new clothes situation? How do these people get to the positions where they can influence what art will fetch a high price, and is this a good system? If not, what would be the alternative? That's a juicy question there.
Well, I don't want to defend the art market, which is, of course, a barbaric and evil place. I will say that there's a lot of art that I've liked and no NFTs that I've liked. NFTs are like, what if you took everything bad about the art market and didn't have any art.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. And I mean, I think Jerry is kind of like honed in on it in the question here. I mean, it's really striking, right? When you think of an NFT, what do you think of? Well, most likely you think of that bored yacht ape or whatever. Like, think Jimmy Fallon and Paris Hilton, like, you know, showcasing their, you know, stupid NFTs during that conversation that kind of, if you watch it, seems like it's a hostage video. Like, there's a guy standing just off in the corner with like a ammo belt and an AK-47 with like title cards about how, you know, NFTs really allow you to express yourself. But no, like in that conversation and with NFTs in general, there's like no pretense that these have artistic value at all, which whereas like I do think even in the most pretentious corners of the fine art world, we're talking about like very abstract, you know, performance. Like just think about like the most stereotypical, like something that dares you to just call it out as not art with everything it does. Like even there, like there is still generally, I think, a pretense to artistic value, or perhaps in some of the like Warhol stuff that, you know, that Will is fonder of than me, really. But it's like there, a lot of times it seems to me, I don't know if you agree with this, Will, but it's drawing its claim to artistic legitimacy comes from its assertion of art, like of negativity, of absence. It's like, okay, well, this is anti-art, but that's still art or something. And like, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with that, I do think there's still an artistic premise that's being maintained. Whereas like, yeah, look at the bored yacht ape, look at Trump's NFTs, which are like so fucking ugly. And yeah, there's no like pretense that this is about anything other than just like being a marketplace. With the Fallon Paris Hilton video, I guess there's some like Paris Hilton said something in that conversation where it's like, oh, this allows me to express, I can customize it and express myself. But it's like, that's just marketing. That's bullshit.
Yeah. Without calling the art world a meritocracy, which it absolutely is not, you still have to get a kind of critical mass of people. Maybe not a huge audience, but a critical mass of people who are not the artist and the curator and the dealer to be persuaded that this is worth looking at. So there's that element to it. But with NFTs, it's like the appeal is that it may make money one day. That's the appeal. Like, people aren't looking at NFTs for no reason other than that, I don't think. They're not looking, like, you've got to get a certain number of people to go to the gallery and agree, I'm looking at this even though I'm not making any money from it. I'm looking at it for the pleasure of looking at it.
Yeah. Actually, this makes me think, you know, someday we should talk about that documentary, Exit Through the Gift Shop, which is like...
I love that documentary.
It's interesting. It's kind of like branded as the Banksy documentary. It is about Banksy, but I'm forgetting the name of the other guy who's like, who sort of domesticates Banksy and like...
Mr. Brainwash.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to talk about. Got a different kind of question up next here from Daniel, who says, you were drafted in the 2028 Summer Olympics. For the next 4 years, you will be intensely trained in the sport of your choosing, your rent and bills and meals all paid for, with the goal of at least winning a bronze. What sport do you think you might actually have a shot at winning a medal, provided the opportunity of training every waking day for 4 years? And what sport would be the most fun for you to train and compete in? Well, I think I know the answer. Will, how about you?
Well, I'm an old man now, so take it as a given. There's no chance, even with 4 years of nonstop training, that I would be able to get a medal. But the one that I would most like to do, and the one that I think I would have the best time at and might stand some chance at mastering, would be some form of martial arts. Right. I've always preferred the solitary sports to the team sports. You know, I did karate when I was in high school for a few years, and I liked it quite a bit.
What belt did you get to?
I think orange, you know, so don't cross me in a dark alley. I enjoy memorizing the katas. I enjoy like the philosophical side of it. I like all that Bruce Lee stuff.
Well, yeah, be like water.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. That stuff's fun to me. So I would have a good time doing that. And these days, it's hard to find time to do that. And it's hard to find the space in dense urban Toronto to, you know, just practice that stuff. So
what kind of karate did you do?
No idea. The kind of karate at the local community center.
Well, people may be interested to know, I trained in the Goju style of karate, which is peculiar to the island of Okinawa. I also studied Kabuto, which is weapons training, and I learned how to use a staff and rice flails, which are a crazy thing to use. And I was good at the staff and not so good at the other stuff when it came to the weapons. I miss karate, actually. That was like a pretty big part of my life for a while. I didn't realize we'd both done it. For me, I think my answer to this, which actually, by the way, Will, don't sell yourself short, because if you started training in like archery right now, or I think darts is in the Olympics, you actually probably could win a medal in 4 years, right?
What about Tai Chi? That's a kind of good martial arts for guys of our vintage, right? You know? I think we could beat some of the seniors at the park.
Well, I still do train 5 or 6 days a week, so I'm still laboring under the delusion that I could take this question seriously and start training for the Olympics. I'm sure a few more years will cure me of that. But for me, I think the one would be triathlon, because I really think that there's something about, like, I don't know, just the fact that it combines three different things, and it is such an incredible test of, I don't know, the human physique. And I'm just in awe of, like even completing a triathlon's amazing. Being able to do it competitively at the Olympics or anywhere else, that'd be super cool. Fuck, maybe I'll start training for triathlon. I don't know. We got a couple questions from Los Pacos here. Put them on the table both at once, and we can answer them in tandem. For both the hosts, what is your opinion of these social events that are trying to bridge the loneliness gap in modern Western societies? Are those good faith attempts to help people build meaningful connections, or is another way for capitalism to make the human experience into a commodity? E.g., I read about events where people can meet random strangers to have deep and meaningful conversations, such as Connection Fest. Okay, and there's a link to that. Second question, what do you think is the best, worst, and weirdest movie giveaway item you have or think you would receive to see a particular movie? This would be in similar to the free items they give away at sports games, such as bobbleheads, t-shirts, flags, etc.
Well, to the first question, you're asking if it's just another way, these connection events, these loneliness tonic events, are just another way for capitalism to make the human experience into a commodity. The answer is yes, they are. But what else is new? Aren't most things in our wretched world another way for capitalism to make human experience into a commodity? If I were struggling with something like this, I would probably sign up, you know?
Well, I don't know. I'm not able to speak to this specific. I said Connection Fest. It's actually Connection Feast. I'm not able to speak to this specifically, but I think the answer to the question for me is very directly just like, I don't know, is this an app? Is someone profiting from this? Is it rent seeking? And I mean, if not, I don't see any... like random meet and greets and that kind of thing is perfectly good. I think that, I don't know, to take the question more seriously, I mean, I do think there are certain properties of our society in the 21st century which are just more atomizing and more alienating for most of us than, you know, an equivalent experience even 30 years ago, but certainly 50, 60, 70 years ago. They're just all kinds of communal spaces that don't exist anymore, both when it comes to the transformation of workplaces, but also public spaces. And there's so many things here, you know, the decline line of church attendance, like you name it. So I think the principle of just like going and randomly meeting strangers, if it's not about rent seeking, I think that's probably a healthy development, and it's something all of us would probably be better served to get in the habit of doing. As to the second question, the weirdest movie giveaway item you have or think you could receive. I don't know, Will, I'm drawing a blank here. How about you?
Well, I remember reading that when Monty Python and the Holy Grail opened in New York, the first like 800 people to show up got a free coconut. You know, the pythons handed them a free coconut, and some people asked them to autograph the coconuts, which apparently it's very hard to autograph a coconut. I wonder if any of those people still have their coconut from the premiere of that movie. As to ones I've received, when I was in grade one, I went to see the movie The Phantom with Billy Zane, and my mom and I were the only two people in the theater, and I got a plastic Phantom ring, which was made out of plastic and which I wore for like the next year. It had a little skull on it, and it eventually fell off. So that's the one that holds the fondest place in my heart, my Billy Zane Phantom ring, rest in peace.
Well, I mean, I guess I was struggling to come up with an answer to this question, but I guess when I saw Star Wars The Phantom Menace in theaters, I mean, they did have that giveaway where they gave you a full-size workable Gungan sub, and, you know, I take that for a spin constantly.
Eric the Bedhumper is in the house. He asks, have you seen the awful Pelican Brief? I believe he's referring to the Julia Roberts movie, The Pelican Brief. Have you seen The Pelican Brief, Luke?
No, I don't even know what The Pelican Brief is, but, you know, we've got a few questions from Eric in the past who has a Doug Walker avatar here. And I just want to say, like, you know, we are in an age of loneliness, but, you know, it's just a bed. It's not love. Anyway, no, what the fuck's The Pelican Brief?
I don't know. I've never seen it. Julia Roberts is in it. Eric, should we watch The Pelican Brief? Pitch The Pelican Brief to us. Eric is a well-documented fan of Howard Stern. He asks, wait a minute. I misinterpreted his question. In fairness, it's not clearly written, Eric. Yeah, it's not the most lucidly articulated question. I think The Pelican Brief in this context apparently refers to Howard Stern's leaked awful PowerPoint presentation to his staff on YouTube. This was the beginning of the end of his entertaining show. I haven't seen that, but I take your word for it, because there's nothing worse than Howard Stern these days. He fucking sucks.
Can I just say, like, Eric's avatar, which is Doug Walker, the nostalgia critic, and that guy, the angry video game nerd. What if we just made that, like, our avatar for the show? What if we just did that and dared fucking Doug Walker to sue us? Jackson says, I'm somewhat surprised that, to my knowledge, Michael and Us has not really addressed the new sincerity. Given that most formulations of new sincerity in popular culture link it to the alleged post 9/11 end of irony, it seems like a trend that should merit attention. Any thoughts from either of you on the new sincerity, especially in the film of the 2000s and early 2010s?
I've heard of the new sincerity. I associate it sort of with David Foster Wallace. Radical lack of irony among guys who, like, would be irony guys. I don't know. An oversight. I should learn a little bit more about the new sincerity, because I do not trust the new sincerity. I think it's a bad idea. And yeah, I do remember a lot of talk about, yeah, the end of irony after 9/11. And irony is nothing more or less than, like, just a coping mechanism. It's like a defense strategy. I think there's a perception that irony and humor is, like, this way to, like, distance oneself from atrocity, as a way to, like, feel smugly superior to it. And I don't subscribe to that at all. I think it's just another, like, a mode of rhetoric. I think it's, like, oftentimes a mode of understatement.
Yeah, no, I see it the same way. I mean, I think it can be a way to distance yourself from things. It can be a way to, like, yeah, to just not express what you're actually feeling. But I also think, like, certainly when I think of the brand of leftist irony that's come in vogue over the past, like, you know, 6 to 8 years, to me, it's more a way to express what you're feeling by, yeah, as you put it, understating it. Like, you say the inverse of the thing you mean, but in doing so, you reveal, you know, often more expressively the thing you actually mean. I mean, I don't feel qualified enough to speak to the specific cultural trend that's, like, the new sincerity, capital N, capital S. I mean, it seems to be a very broad term. Like, I've seen it applied to, like, way back to, like a movie like Bonnie and Clyde, but then you also see it applied to, like, the Titanic, or, like, the films of Wes Anderson, or, like, fucking apparently the Timothy Chalamet Wonka movie. And I don't know. It seems kind of a diaphanous concept. I will say that when I was the first time I remember encountering the concept of the new sincerity, it probably would have been around about, like, 2012, and I remember at the time being very skeptical of it. It seemed to be describing something that was less sincerity than a particular niche of millennial twee, like a sort of nostalgic longing for, like, oh, hey, it's 2003. It's like we're listening to the Shins. Like, turn over the record. We got Neutral Milk Hotel. By the way, nothing against either of those bands. It's just there's a particular 2003 mode that those of you of the right generation will know what I'm talking about. And yeah, I don't know, we're watching Juno, we got No Time for Irony, and it's like, yeah, I don't know, obviously this is a total straw man, I'm just telling you what my association with it is, but I think both irony and sincerity can be useful modes in in art and in communication. I don't think we have to choose one or the other, but I will just say, as a further qualifier, since Jackson, who asked the question, I think is a little more versed in the specific discourse than we are, I agree that the topic merits further further discussion, and you'll get that from the two of us when we've had time to think about it some more.
So Savage Luke and Sloan Will, that's the handle, his actual name is Ian, asks, you are in a fight to the death with an evil clone of yourself. You are offered an aluminum baseball bat or a 6-inch non-serrated knife. Knowing the other weapon you don't choose goes to your opponent, which one will you wield, knife or bat? Well, I would not try to kill the evil clone of myself. If anything, I would try to be friends with that clone, and maybe we could even explore each other's bodies. But if a fight is to happen, I would take the baseball bat. I think I could do a lot of damage in a really short amount of time with a baseball bat. With a knife, I think you have to be a little more strategic.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have like a funny answer to this question. I think I'd go with the baseball bat as well. But you know what it reminds me of? This reminds me of something that absolutely terrified me as a kid, which this is like, I don't want to derail us too much, but The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, okay? Folks, when I was a kid, I did play it. I had friends who played it all the way through. After you get past like the sort of first, whatever, 20% of it where Link is a child and you go into the future through the Temple of Time and everything is all like Hyrule is all burning and scary and there are demons everywhere. I don't think I finished that game until I played it on an emulator when I was like at university. Like things like the Shadow Temple, just too scary for me. But something that absolutely terrified me was the fight with, I think he's called Dark Link. It's like a boss fight. I think it's the Spirit Temple. Don't quote me on that. I don't know if you remember this well, but it's like an opponent that's an exact mirror image of you. Every attack you do, he just copies it. And it's really hard to know what to do. And I think what you do is you have to like repeat the same attack and then he gets like stuck doing it. And that's how you hit him. But there was something about that that as a child I thought was like viscerally like one of the scariest. I thought that was like the scariest idea that it like possible that you could meet an evil clone of yourself and have to fight it. So anyway, what I'm getting at here is it's a trick question. I would not go with the bat or the other thing. I would go with the giant's knife. Okay. And not the one that breaks, the one that you get fixed through that really convoluted side quest that had us all pulling our hair out when we were kids.
Alexander asks, as someone also in my 30s, I've had cause to ponder Bob Dylan's statement that the worst fear that can ever be hurled is the fear to bring children into the world. How do you two grapple with the existential question of siring offspring at the end of history, and how do you deal with the pressure from the older generation who had it easier? What got me thinking about this was Nick Cave recently wrote that becoming a parent was an outrageous act of positive intentionality, faith in the human adventure itself, of resistance against cynicism, of pure, undiluted trust in things. We are switching gears in this question, aren't we?
I would use the giant's knife. The statement that Alec quotes here from Nick Cave, I like that. I think that's basically right. The Bob Dylan thing he quotes, of course, is from Masters of War, where the Dylan character is, in the song is sort of talking about how, you know, the Masters of War have instilled him with a fear of bringing children into the world, possibly because of the threat of nuclear war, though I don't think that's directly clear in the song. I don't know. I don't really have anything. I don't have anything profound to say here because I feel like Nick Cave has already done the work. I mean, if this is something you want to do, that is a wonderfully poetic way to put it, as an outrageous act of positive intentionality.
Shane asks, for the rest of your life, your theater going experiences are either alone, you or you and a partner, but no strangers, or completely brim-packed with huffing and puffing rubes and movie mindset acolytes alike. You choose. I would obviously go for the latter. I love the communal experience. I love the hum and the purr of the unwashed masses. What do you think?
I love the way this question is phrased. I think there's a little confirmation bias going in here that obviously didn't work on Will, because it's like, you know, the question is like, would you rather watch like, you know, films with like you and like, you know, your
girlfriend,
one or, you know, or would you like to be in a room with like gap-toothed yokels who are like hooting and hollering and, you know, one of them falls off the stage in front of the screen with like a bottle with three X's on it. And, you know, it's like, I don't don't know. Will says the latter, I say the former. Come on.
Adam asks, this one's for both of you, but it's been something I've been thinking about for a while. How do you navigate various bad actors on the left or tankies? Are they a major concern in your estimation? Ever since I've been engaging with socialism and the many voices from the left that are rightly critical of our current Western liberal hegemony, I've been frustrated by prominent individuals who will throw in some take or propaganda that is favorable towards an authoritarian regime, for instance, the current Russian regime. I understand a lot of lies are spread about them or even past communist countries by liberals, but it seems wild and highly counterproductive to twist or ignore atrocities and other negative aspects of said regimes. Luke, you want to tackle this one?
Well, there's a little more to the question here. They said, I think there was one final comment here. It seems their attitude is that if a regime portrays itself as anti-U.S. imperialism, then they're on the side of good, even if they're engaged in terrible oppressive actions themselves. Yeah, I definitely have sympathy with this question. I mean, I think the reason this is often so difficult to navigate is because the most common line of attack against the organized left for more than 100 years, right? Has been, and particularly, you know, from the onset of the Cold War, has been that, you know, oh, you actually support tyranny, right? Like, if you oppose, like, say, you know, take an obvious example, the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, you are objectively pro-Saddam, as one commentator so ignominiously put it. And so I think because of that, right, it's a natural reaction. People are so used to these bad faith attacks that they, you know, in some cases almost sort of lean into them. And it's like, well, such and such a regime is not that bad. And, you know, sometimes that's true. Sometimes the depravities of, you know, foreign countries or their governing regimes are wildly overstated or sometimes invented whole cloth by propagandists for self-interested reasons. But I mean, come on. I mean, the questioner asked about Putin's Russia. I mean, like, Putin's Russia is like an oligarchical state that is, you know, maintains this like very thin veneer of parliamentary democracy. But everybody knows that that's not real. You know, it is a place where civil liberties are suppressed, where there is aggressive state propaganda in many places, where there's also a regime of moral regulation, if I can put it that way, that's enforced by the state, which is, you know, in alliance to a certain extent with the Orthodox Church and that kind of thing. And so, like, there's no... There's obviously no sense in pretending that's good. I think the extent to which anybody does pretend that a regime like that is good is often itself exaggerated. I think if people focus on the crimes and injustices perpetrated by their own countries, that's perfectly natural and it's more constructive, right? I mean, I can't write to my local representative in the Duma to ask Putin to lay off in Ukraine, but I actually can write to my local representative when it comes to issues of, you know, Canadian policy.
I think when one has sort of given up on the empire in which one is born and raised, it would be nice. It's nice to think that there are better options out there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, and this kind of gets at the other thing I wanted to say, which is there are cases, right, of people adopting a kind of infantile, like, third worldism or whatever, where, you know, it's not that they're overlooking bad features of other societies. It's that they are telling themselves, actually, these things are good. Like, civil liberties are overrated. Free expression is overrated. Independent trade unions, overrated. You don't need that. And I mean, that obviously needs to be opposed. But of course, that constituency, such as it is very small, very influential, and much less powerful or holding any intellectual sway than its equivalents used to be. It'd be nice to have something positive to say at the end of this. So let me just put it this way. I mean, it can be hard to navigate the thickets of discourse, you know, good faith, bad faith, actors of various kinds intervening in these discussions, often against the backdrop of very contentious global events. But we should just never lose sight of the world that we want, which is one in which, you know, I don't think we have to choose between civil and political liberties on the one hand and economic and social justice on the other. I think there is no reason why there needs to be some trade-off between, like, rampant present grotesque class inequality, clamping down on eliminating that or significantly reducing it on the one hand, or just, you know, having liberal freedoms, civil liberties, the right to vote, whatever, on the other. We want both, you know. So as difficult as these debates can be to navigate, we don't on a deep level need to, as it were, pick sides here. We want a world where there's freedom and justice for everyone. And that can sometimes be lost in the context of these sorts of debates.
Michael asks, if you could instantly learn and then speak a language, which one would it be and why? For me, my head says probably Mandarin, you know, because it's really hard and because it's the way of the future. My heart says French, because there's a lot of French film criticism that I'd like to read. Now, French is a very easy language to learn, and yet I failed at it as a school child. What about you, Luke?
Didn't you also fail at a Chinese exam once? Isn't that one of your stories?
Well, I failed at a Chinese history.
Right.
Yeah, I had to drop out at Chinese history class when I was in undergrad. It's just like, okay, this is what I'll say about that, okay? American history is very easy because we've been immersed in it. So it's like, I don't have to spend a long time remembering the name of Lincoln or Washington, but just memorizing the names of all the dynasties in order, and then that's just their names. Man, I found Chinese history very hard to do an exam on.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on how shittily I did in the course I had to do for a science credit. Awful. For me, it would be, it'd just pragmatically would probably be French. There's a lot of French literature I'd like to read. And also, it's just, you know, it's the second most common spoken language in Canada. The history of Quebec, as people will know, has always interested me. And like, I can't read any of the stuff that's not, hasn't been translated into English. So that sucks. I would say, secondly, though, just for purely literary reasons, Russian. I mean, it'd be amazing to be able to read Tolstoy, Chekhov, Dostoevsky in the original Russian. That'd be amazing. If you could raise a family in any continent and you had to stay there, which one would it be? That's the second part of the question. Europe.
Yeah, I guess so. Although probably still this continent for me, because it's what I know. Matt says, I really enjoyed your recent episode on Passion of the Christ, particularly your discussions of its place in the culture circa 2004 and your theological reading of its success with evangelical audiences. Will, as a fellow lapsed Catholic, I'm curious if you feel any aspects of the church teaching, for better or worse, still shape your sense of morality and how you see the world. Also, I'd like to hear if any of you have any other canonical films to add to the Michael and Us Nation sanctioned Catholic catechism. Thanks, as always, for the show. So the bad way that Catholicism has shaped my life and morality is anything to do with sex. The good way that it's shaped my life and morality is the idea that anyone can be redeemed, no matter how abject. I think that's a potentially interesting idea.
And actually, that's funny because it sort of gets us to the second part of the question. Sorry, I interrupted you, but if I can just answer the second part of the question, this being the only contribution I can make here, the Catholic Catechism, I mean, the Bad Lieutenant, right? Not the Portocult, not the Herzog one, but the original. Like, it explores these questions in a way that's very interesting.
Yeah, that was the one I was going to suggest. That's probably my favorite Catholic movie. And then finally, a few questions here from Eric the Bed Humper again. Eric gives us a couple of different videos to watch, a cartoon and a WWE Raw debate between alpha male Scott Steiner and liberal cuck Christopher Nowinski from Harvard on the war in Iraq. these look like some interesting documents, Eric. I gotta say, I would like to explore these. But he also asks, will you do a review of the moment that broke the internet, the Nostalgia Critic versus Angry Video Game Nerd feud? Well, when we were just out for drinks with our friend Alex Ross a few nights ago, we were talking about how we need to do an episode at some point on Angry Video Game Nerd the Movie, which was the self-funded feature film that he made in the 2000s. I think the people deserve some shit internet content again sometime.
Those have been among our most popular episodes, which is crazy because, I mean, that first one where you and Alex introduced me to the Nostalgia Critic.
Kickassia.
Yeah, there was that movie Kickassia, which, like, That was like one of the worst things I've ever seen. And I found it like so impenetrable. And I just found like my mind, like I was just disassociating. I was like, who am I? You know, what is this? What is this thing called a podcast that I do? Is it worth it? I remember feeling an urge to go out and live in the woods, like the character at the end of Jack Kerouac's The Dharma Bums, where he just like lives in that fire tower for the summer and like departs from civilization. That's what I wanted to do after watching that. And then we watched The Nostalgia Critic's The Wall. And after that, I wanted to, you know, like a monk protesting the Vietnam War, coat myself in gasoline and set myself on fire. So yeah, it'd be interesting to find out. Let's see what it does.